Located on Silverado Trail, the Stag's Leap District of Napa Valley produces some of the finest Cabernet Sauvignon grapes in all of California. And on this winding, hilly stretch of road, with a little searching, you'll find Schaefer Vineyards, the home of Hillside Select, one of the most interesting wines in the country. John Schaefer, chairman of Schaefer Wines, is an easy man to talk to. His warmth and humor made this an especially fun interview. And the hospitality at Schaefer is exceptional. I was greeted by Tucker, Schaefer's wine dog, as well as a mysterious, turquoise-eyed wine cat roaming the property. John, you were really new to the business, as well as wine itself.
I was not a connoisseur. The first time I ever drank a Cabernet was the Saturday night before I left Hinsdale, Illinois, to drive to California with a friend who gave a dinner party. It was much more getting in on the ground floor of what I thought would be a coming in industry and being my own boss. And so I was really quite ignorant of wine. We're all novices. We're all learning all the time.
John, tell me about your beginnings with wine.
The start in the wine business really relates to the last job I had working for a textbook publishing company, Scott Forsman. And that job was created by the management consultants, and it involved long-range planning. And it was really a gadfly job because the company was very old, had slight corporate hardening of the arteries, and they wanted to reinvigorate it. And so they created a job with the idea that it would involve investigating trends, new ideas, that would end up with new products and so on. So I did that for 6 or 7 or 8 years and got involved with some wonderful things like early childhood education, which was way ahead of its time. I was directing products to the home, to parents, to work with very, very young children. That was 68. When I realized that I didn't want to continue this forever, it was a staff job, not a line job. Then in 69, I was just starting to drink some wine, Lancer's Rosé and Matus. I applied to my personal life what I've been doing with the company, which was to study and read a lot about what was going on in the wine business, especially here in California. And the more I read, the more I realized that it would be an opportunity to get on the ground floor and be my own boss and work outside, which I love to do. So all of those persuaded me to resign and move my family here, 1972.
Tell me about your approach to getting the Schaefer name out to the public.
One of the things I started early on was to practice guerrilla marketing. And I had the idea of putting display bottles in wine racks in Williams-Sonoma and Crate and Barrel. So at first we put colored water in these bottles. Later we painted them, you know. But we got a letter one day from Florida, this lady, and she said, I want you to know I had this experience. I bought one of your bottles, the Cabernet, and I invited my boss over for dinner. And, you know, we opened the bottle and we poured it out, and he made this funny face, you know, and he said, yeah, this really doesn't taste like wine to me. And, of course, somebody had lifted one of those bottles out of that wine rack, taken it in their store, and sold it. I said, I think you better go back and talk to your retailer.
How did you end up choosing this property in the Stag's Leap District?
To back up in history, those first 6 years, because I didn't know anything, I devoted to growing grapes. I really put aside the idea of getting into the wine business, even though that's what brought me out here. Because I knew nothing. I would never have started a winery without having the grapes and having control over them from the beginning, although neighbors and friends, Dan Duckhorn, did it the other way. He went and found very good vineyards and grapes and was very successful. And now everybody realizes that having control of your grapes is part of the secret to producing high-quality wines. See, because you have control over what goes on in the vineyard. The pruning and everything is critical to the winemaking. And so this vineyard had been planted in 1922. So in 72, it was 50 years old, planted to standard varietal grapes, Carignan, Sauvignon Vert, a little Zinfandel, and so on. I set about redoing the vineyards bit by bit. My neighbor to the south, Nathan Fay, was the first grower to have planted Cabernet Sauvignon in this area, known then as the Stag's Leap area, since then as the Stag's Leap District Appellation. But Manuel Barboza next door and Laurie Wood and our farm advisor, everybody said, this is a perfect place for Cabernet. And we dug test holes and so on. And so I said, well, that's fine. Let's do it. That was 73 and 74 when we started. And so we've converted over the years to the point where now the 50 acres that we have is almost exclusively Cabernet.
You've been practicing sustainable farming for quite some time now, haven't you?
When we purchased this 72, and of course we moved here in January 73, I immediately got started with the vineyards. And I had that first 2 years, we had a management company working with us, and I was learning from them. And then from then on, I did it myself with Alfonso, who we've had a long, long association. In those days, drip irrigation was just beginning. And we had overhead sprinklers, and we even put some of those in for a short time. But essentially, we were doing as everybody did. The idea was that you wanted to get rid of all the weeds because they competed for moisture with the roots, with the grapevines. So you want to get rid of them. So with the advice I had from graduates from the University of California in viticulture and so on, was to go through every May and June, especially when we had this crop of leafhoppers, they're called leafhoppers, and spray for them. So we would both spray for the weeds, and we would also spray for the leafhoppers, because the leafhoppers are a little tiny thing. You can see them, but they get on the back of a leaf, and if there's more than four or five, they will eat through, and the leaf will become mottled, and that mottling affects the photosynthesis negatively, which carries over to the wine and the development of sugar. So you want to get rid of them. So they said, this is the way you do. You take the Saigon, which is a common name for a very nasty pesticide, and you pour it a little bit, and then you fill it up. And so we used to do that. And, of course, you killed everything. You didn't kill the bad bugs. You killed the good bugs, too. And then we sprayed for the weeds, too. So when I would go through with a tractor, when the disc and a drag board behind it, and it was, you'd look back and you'd see these beautiful, smooth, it was just gorgeous, pristine. I used to take great pride in this. Well, as we went along in 89, Doug said, okay, I'm ready to take over some of the vineyards. So Doug had met a guy named Amigo Bob, who wore little sandals and shorts no matter what the temperature was, and he was into the whole matter of sustainable ag. He was very early on, and he's helped the neighbors. And so he convinced Doug to try out the idea of planting cover crops. And beyond the cover crops, we would get into hawk perches and owl boxes. So Doug took over the vineyards, and one of the first things he did in talking to this consultant was to experiment with the idea of getting into what some people call natural farming or sustainable farming or integrated pest management, all kinds of names. And that involved planting cover crops between the rows of using clover, peas, vetch, mustard, you can plant mustard, and going through and instead of turning the soil over and cultivating it, mowing it about 2 and 3 feet high, keeping it mowed. Well, the beauty of that was that that cover crop served as a habitat or a housing development, if you will, for ladybugs, lacewings, spiders, mites, and they're all in there. And they, in May and June, when we would used to have to do the spraying to get rid of these leafhoppers, they would come up with the leaves and they would eat the leafhoppers. Magical. Well, one thing leads to another, though. In planting that cover crop, then those roots, that attracted a lot of gophers and moles. So when the rain stopped in April and May, those little critters would gravitate over to the line where we had the grapevines, where they were drip irrigated, and there was moisture in the soil. And with a young vine, they would eat the roots of the young vine. Not a mature vine, but a young vine. So that caused us to build hawk perches, 20-foot-high perches, so that our red-tailed hawks and red-shouldered hawks would have a little place to perch and scope for these little guys. And at nighttime, we put up owl boxes, barn owl boxes. And since then, we've done insect, bird boxes for little, to get insects. So that we got started with very early, and it was, we were one of the few at the beginning. Now it's more and more widespread, but not totally. There are still people practicing the old way. A funny story about that is that Alfonso got involved with this, and of course he had been with me. Well, when Doug took over and we started doing this, the whole business of having the vineyard look pristine and clean and neat and everything went by the boards. We had all these different things growing up, and it was very ragged. And Alfonso's friends, these other vineyard managers and workers at other ranches, would say to Alfonso when they came over, "What's happened? What are you doing in this vineyard? Why aren't you paying attention to this?" And Alfonso got all upset there for a while until we educated him. But now he's okay. He understands. Doug and I trust each other. I'll have different ideas. And he said, "Go ahead," you know, or I'll say, "You know, let's do it." And but we felt it was really the right thing to do. And long term, as stewards of the land, you know, we're here for a short time, all of us.
And now you're solar powered as well. When did that take place?
We went solar 2.5 years ago, and 100% solar, meaning that we have no electricity for our budget. And of course, the meter runs backwards, you know. There's a final accounting at the end of the year. If we use more electricity than we make and sell back, then we have to pay the difference. If we, however, make more and set it into the grid than we use, we don't get anything back. I mean, we don't get any credit. So if there's a final accounting at the end of 12 months. So you want to size your unit so that you come out pretty even. And we recycle our water, by the way. We use it in the winery, and then we use it again and irrigate the vineyards.
There seems to be some misconceptions about Napa Valley, and you're also very involved in the community here.
You know, we're very, very grateful, and that's one of the reasons that I'm interested and have been in giving back and doing some things with our nonprofits here. A lot of people think of the Napa Valley as being this ritzy place with all these 30,000-foot mansions and so on, but let me tell you, there's 25-30% of our people are really in the poverty area and the great needs. People don't tend to realize that. The one that I've been longest involved with is Clinic Olay, which is a community health clinic, which is for people, uninsured people, you know, and 70% are Hispanic. 50% work in our vineyards and wineries here. We have no county hospital in Napa County. And so, you know, these people, without the clinic, which is started in 72, coincidentally, just the year we came, people would go to the emergency room with all the attendant costs and concerns. But this has been very successful here in the county, and I've been a part of that. When I was on the board, the Clinic Olay Board of Directors, and this goes back in, 12 years or so, they were paying a lot of rent, and they decided they want to have their own building. And I took on the task of working on that, and in the process did something that is, I believe, rather unique. We got a total of 4 health-oriented nonprofits: the health clinic, a dental clinic, children's abuse clinic, and healthy moms and babies for young. And we asked them if they would be willing to collaborate and share a building and share the waiting room and the conference rooms and the kitchens. And they said yes. And so we got through the auction seed money, and we bought some property. And then we later got another $2 million, and then I raised another $6 million. We raised $9 million and built a 25,000-square-foot building in the city of Napa called the Napa Valley Vendors Community Health Center. And they all have their own board of directors, and we have a little board that takes care of the property management, but they pay $1.12 a square foot for their services, and it's a beautiful building. And that's versus $3.50 a square foot. So all that money they save by not paying rent, they put into services. So that's been a great success here. They're serving 20,000 patients and then 40,000, 45,000 patient visits. So it's been a great success for the Valley.
So what do you like to drink? And do you ever get the chance to sample your neighbor's wines?
Well, my wife is enamored of Gruner Veltliner from Austria. It's a very light wine, not a lot of oak, and so I end up drinking that with her. But otherwise, I'm really interested in experimenting and tasting the new wines, the Malbecs and the Tempranillos and blends. Now, there's a lot of blends going on, which is sort of fun to see what they're doing with that. We're using a little Petit Verdot in our 1.5, only 2%, but other wineries are using more, and it's sort of interesting. It's a long-time Bordeaux varietal, but it hasn't had a lot of exposure in this country until now. Now, it's so things like that. I never order our own wines. When I'm out, there's so many, as we all know, there's so many wines out there and very good wines, so I love to experiment and taste other people's wines.
As chairman, what is your role at the winery today?
Well, I'm involved with policy decisions with Doug. I instituted our international some years ago, 15, 20 years ago, and we're now selling to over 20 countries, albeit small amounts for the most part, except for three large markets. So I'm doing a little bit of that, mainly trying to stay out of Doug's way and avoid saying to him, why didn't you do it my way? But he's wonderful. He keeps me in the loop. But that's why I'm involved with local stuff, local nonprofits, the sculpting a little, so on. I've got a son who runs this show, and he runs it beautifully. And he can do everything I can do and more.
I'm on the Schaefer mailing list, and I get the promotional teaser card mailed a few times a year.
Oh, you mean the line on wine? Oh, well, that was developed by a gal named Julie Morrison more than 10 years ago, I would say, 12, 13, 14 years ago. She got the idea from the Harper's Magazine, Harper's Index, which had an index of literary things that they pulled together and put out. And she started that, and it's been a great success. They're pulling from different journals, little bits, tidbits, trivia, if you will, of wine. It's sort of fun, and we did a sort of a thing, and then it's now, of course, it's become a tradition. We do it three times a year. One thing happened to Frank Pryl, the former wine writer for the New York Times. I was having dinner with him three or four years ago. He had written it up once and was very complimentary and called it a newsletter. He said, there's this winery that puts out this newsletter and they don't say anything about their own wine. He said, they're just talking about other things. Well, of course, it wasn't a newsletter. It was just a... But during dinner, he said, you ought to pull some of those together and put them on in a book. And so we did, and our Andy Dembski went through and pulled out the more timeless ones, put them together in a book called Line on Wine, and I in turn went back to Frank Proud and said, would you write a foreword to this for us, which he did very nicely. It's been a fun thing to do.
It looks like wine is bigger than ever.
Well, as you know, just this last year, wine sales have exceeded beer sales for the first time in history, and I've been very surprised that all of a sudden, like almost overnight, the United States has become a wine-drinking nation. And if we were sitting here 6, 7 years ago, 10 years ago, I would have said, it's never going to happen. Never going to happen in my lifetime. Because it was active on either coast and so on, but in the middle of the country. And I can remember going to places in Georgia and others. And I deliberately, this is 10 years ago or so, looked in at a restaurant to see if there are any wine bottles on the table. There weren't any, you know. And so it has surprised me greatly that it's taken off so fast. And I think it's just in the last 5 years or so. So that all of a sudden America is, you know, it's many, many people of, average means are drinking wines these days. And of course, there's some very good, inexpensive wines. And that's wonderful. That helps us all. So it's great.
You have the wine mailing list, but not a wine club.
We don't have a wine club. A great majority of wineries do. And one of the reasons we don't is that we've really put a lid on our production. We've chosen, and Doug and I go through this all the time, we've chosen really not to expand and grow in quantity. And our goal is to grow in quality. But that puts a huge burden on us. Because as everybody knows, if you're in business, there's only two ways to make money. One is to make more of your widgets or whatever, or the other is to raise the price. And so we have a self-imposed ceiling almost in a way. And Doug's almost really stronger about that than I am, but it's a real burden, because that burden is quality, because you're certainly not going to raise your price unless the quality's there. So it's a it's a big nut.
You were featured in an episode of Bravo's Top Chef in its first season. Tell me about that.
Well, I went on the coattails of the wine. The deal of that particular program was that they took our, I think, 2001 Hillside and said to the chefs, okay, here's the wine, now go out and develop a recipe and food that would go with it. And so they wanted to have the wine there, so they invited me along. Actually, I think they wanted Doug, and he was out of town. But that was a fun experience.
Schaefer, like other wines, is about family. So where do you see the future of the name?
It's a good question, and we're talking about it. We're starting to talk about it. I have 13 grandchildren. But the oldest is 24. They go from 24 to 3. So it's early, but that's going to be their decision. My decision, and I think it's an important one, is that there's no hand from the grave saying, I want to have a dynasty and this has got to go on for you. Be sure you do what I say. Things are changing too rapidly these days for anybody to know what's going to be going on 10 years from now. But we're learning about it. And we're thinking about it, and we're going to see whether or not any of the kids have any interest, for one thing. It might be nice. Might work nicely.
Many books have been published about Napa wine dogs, and Tucker is a well-known wine dog. So why are there no wine cats?
Good question. We've never fostered wine cats. The cats just appear for us out of nowhere. Our neighbors have had different cats, and they go wild and so on. And the cats come and they adopt us, and then sometimes they stay a long time and sometimes they don't. But it's a good question. I've never had anybody address that. Why dogs and not cats for wineries?
It's also worth noting that Tucker may be the only wine dog that has his own business card, and it features his paw print.